Welcome back to Always Hold On to Smallville, the podcast where we talk about each and every episode of Smallville, the young Superman series that ran from 2001 to 2011. In this episode, I'm joined by Matt Latham, the man behind the Bottle Episode website, where they talk about just old television series. Matt, how's it going?
I'm fine, thank you very much.
Thanks for being on. Now, Matt is my first guest from across the pond.
Yeah. Transatlantic.
Matthew and I actually met, so to speak, through the X-Cast, which is our mutual friend Tony Black's podcast about the X-Files. Similar to our show here about Smallville, that show is about the X-Files. Now, I met Tony through the internet and Twitter and stuff, and you're actually friends with them in real life, right, Matt?
Yeah, I've known him for too long. I mean, too long. But no, he's one of my closest friends, and he's actually been at me to watch the X-Files for years. So I decided to follow on and listen to your first episode, which I can't remember which episode it was. Was it the Jersey Devil?
Correct.
Yeah, and you talked about Smallville, and like, oh, I might check that out, and listen to the first few. And then after about the third podcast, I started to rewatch Smallville and kind of sped up. Originally I was going to follow you on the podcast, but then I think I kind of sped up, and because I'm someone who ends up binge watching a load of stuff, and because I've never watched the X-Files before, I've decided to use Smallville to stop myself from going through the X-Files in about a month. So
yeah, so how are you watching Smallville, by the way?
I've got the DVDs, well, the first three seasons anyway, and I'm watching them online somewhere.
So there you go. We'll leave it at that. Yeah. You know, Smallville is not an easy show to watch. So I credit anyone that tracks it down and finds it. Fortunately, it is coming to Hulu. That's what the reports say. So at some point during this year, it will be available on Hulu for people. Which I'm glad that, one, it will open up a new audience for the show. And two, hopefully, we'll open up some more audience for this podcast. Because if you're not familiar enough with the show, I mean, you probably aren't going to tune in. I mean, I was like you know, you listen to two or three episodes, you're like, well, I better start watching this show, you know, to kind of keep up.
Yeah, I've not rewatched it for a while, a long while, anyway. So
did you ever watch it, like, back in the day when it was on? Like,
yeah.
How did that work in Britain? Did it come on, like, a year later? I know a lot of shows have quite a delay.
I think it was because around the start of the 2000s, that was when there was a rise in what's called Freeview, which is digital TV, because we've got free-to-air TV, which is the BBC, ITV, Channel 4. And with Freeview, you had about, look, from five channels to about 40-odd if you didn't subscribe to a satellite network and have a dish in front of you. And Channel 4, they've got a side channel called E4, which is more based on teenage young adults TV. I mean, they used to show Friends non-stop. It currently has the Big Bang Theory, Scrubs, and that kind of
okay,
American imports,
right?
And they bought the rights to Smallville, and it used to be shown on Channel 4, the mainstream channel, at like 11:35 in the morning as part of its teenage,
oh boy,
package thing. But then with E4, it used to start showing it on a weeknight. Now, I can't remember what weeknight it was, but it was like 8 p.m. But then they used to show it for the years it used to be on there. And I think eventually I ended up, I can't remember how I watched the last season, but it wasn't on E4.
Yeah, it's just always interesting to hear about how these shows get broadcast across the world, really, because, you know, it's just,
yeah,
but even Smallville, you know, it's 15-year-old show now, the world was very different back then when it came to broadcast. I mean, yeah, you know, we're talking about the X-Files here. You know, we got the X-Files, the revival, you know, every Monday here, and then you guys got it pretty much the next day on iTunes, basically. But through some, I believe some of you guys had to go through some loopholes and stuff to get, like, the American iTunes. But the point is, you could get it. Then they show the X-Files revival like a month later. What is that about, right? It's the 21st century. Come on.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, it felt like it was 2000 again, where, like, my favorite show of all time was Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And that would air in September, and then Sky TV would not show it until January. So it was like that, more or less. But it was on Channel 5, which was which is a really out there channel to get that. But they did get exclusive rights to CSI, so so it's probably not that a jump. But no one would have expected Channel 5 to have got it. But it was like about 6 weeks after it aired.
Hmm. So weird. You know, you mentioned Buffy the Vampire Slayer. You know, that's kind of a spiritual predecessor to Smallville, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think it's probably one of the reasons I ended up watching Smallville in general was because I think my TV taste was warped. Well, let's say warped. It was influenced from Buffy, and I think a lot of my taste came from that show. But yeah, in terms of Smallville, there was very much a metaphor of supernatural or the comic book world crossed over with teenage drama. I don't think Smallville got it as nuanced as Buffy did at times, but Smallville got some really good stuff in terms of that kind of metaphor for teenage life in some episodes. I think Zero, this episode we're going to talk about, kind of touches on a few things as well. But yeah, there's a lot of I think Smallville kind of was like built out of that template, because there was a lot of shows based on teenage characters with genre elements around that time.
Yeah,
there was
Roswell. Yeah,
uh-huh. Yeah. I'm a big fan of Roswell. There was Charmed, but that was slightly aimed at an older audience, but the same kind of thing applied, where you got a genre elements mixed in to explore life as a whole. And I think if you want to get a modern day comparison, I always thought FX is the Americans, which I say is the best TV show at the moment, kind of does that, but with marriage and spies, in how they meld two different genres.
You know, ironically, being American, I have not watched The Americans. So, you know, just a little bit more about your superhero background, comic book background. Were you a fan of Superman or comic books at all before you got into Smallville at all through Buffy? Or, I mean, what's your background as far as, like, superheroes go?
I wasn't much of a comic book guy. I'm not much of a comic book guy in general. I think a lot of my experience was probably from TV shows. I think my first Superman thing was Lois and Clark,
because
that used to be shown on the BBC Two on like Saturday evening, as part, like, you'd have like the Saturday variety shows, then we switch over to BBC Two, you watch Lois and Clark, and then go back to BBC One to watch, I don't know, Noah's Host Party and all this kind of stuff in the 90s, and I really liked Lois and Clark. I'm pretty sure the first comic I got that was Superman was a tie-in with Lois and Clark. But in terms of comics, I don't really have any Superman comics. I don't really collect them. I have a few graphic novels or collections. If I turn around and look at my graphic novel shelf, I've got a couple of Batman ones. It's mainly, I think, Buffy the Vampire Slayer Season 8, 9, Angel and Faith, a couple of Spider-Mans, the IDW Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle series, which I absolutely adore.
Awesome, man. Well, yeah, that's awesome. And you can hear us both as regular guests, or semi-regular guests, I guess, on the X-Cast. So look them up on Twitter and iTunes and wherever podcasts are sold.
Yeah. Also, if you get a chance, X-Cast is part of the Black Hole Media. And there's other podcasts, including Pick a Flick, which Tony sometimes hosts, in which they review certain films that are nominated and stuff. And I fully recommend that as well.
Absolutely, man. Get that plug in. Absolutely. Yep. So,
yeah.
Let's go ahead and jump into talking about Zero.
Nothing to say? I thought Lex Luthor had all the answers.
Lucky twisted son of a bitch. I don't know what you want.
I want to know what happened at Club Zero, the cover-up. You know the cop? One on the report, Phelan? He's dead. It seems that you are somehow involved in that, too. I find that very interesting.
Why don't you kill me now?
Because it's more fun to watch you suffer? Knowing that at any moment, bang!
Zero was first broadcast on March 12, 2002, teleplay by Mark Verheiden, with a story by Alfred Gow and Miles Miller, and it was directed by Michael Cattleman. So Zero starts out in media res. We get our first shot of the episode is Lex, and he's hanging upside down in a straitjacket. You don't really know what's going on.
It won't be the last time that he's in a straitjacket.
Yeah, I thought about that too. It's like, oh, I didn't realize we had seen him in one before, you know, middle of season three. So it gave me some shattered flash forwards. I really like that first shot pulling out from Lex, you know. It's a really creative camera move where it starts out tight on Lex and it pulls out and pretty much does a complete 180, twists upside down. You realize that he's hanging upside down. And that was a real cool, strong way to start the episode, I thought.
Yeah. It's one of the rare times he's in white as well, if you notice. I think it's only that and flash forwards, I think, where you see him in white.
That's true. You know, he does have his, it's always in black, always in gray, always in purple. So unless he's in a straitjacket or the president of the United States, he's not wearing white. So this episode, like I said, it starts out in media res, and I believe I'm gonna add a new category to the Smallville tally board that we do. This will be number one, because this is a trope I feel, and it's fine here, I feel, but this is a trope that they started to use way too much on Smallville. And whenever I saw, like, you know, the opening, like, you can tell in a teaser, like, if it's from, you know, the middle of the episode, like, if we're going to come back around to it, I feel. And whenever an episode of Smallville, I saw something like that, and then we went to the opening credits, and we came back, and it was, like, 48 hours earlier, one day earlier. I'm like, oh, really? We're doing this. So what do you think of that trope? I mean, you think it worked here?
I think it does. I think because you're pretty much setting up, because when you think about how the story and the rest of the episode unfolds, it kind of doesn't really get that exciting. It's more of a mystery, so you need that hook to get people in. So, and it kind of sets up Lex's backstory, more or less. And it, as a storytelling technique, I think the episode actually works better with it in, because you have to kind of have that dramatic hook of, oh, okay, how's Lex going to end up here? Which goes through the rest of the episode. And I think, because the episode works, because I'll bring this up later on, but there's a few things in the episode that work really well, and perhaps because of the media res element of it.
Yeah, I agree with you. It might have been a little boring if they hadn't hooked you. Like, what would have been the opening of this episode, right?
So that's a
good point there. Obviously, this Lex is being accused of something. And it's this figure in the shadows who we don't see, and he's questioning Lex. And then we get this flashback about what happened at Club Zero, and Club Zero, of course, had been referenced in several episodes before. So I'm, you know, kudos to the powers that be for dropping those hints in. And something like an episode like this is much more powerful when it's something that's been built up to. You know, yeah. I mean, we've had hints of what happened in Club Zero. It's been this mystery. Had this just been some random incident in Lex's life we had never been privy to before, it wouldn't have quite been as cool, I think.
No. It's like the end of a mini arc that's been set up.
Yeah.
More or less. There's like a lot of hints to try and throw us in, and I think it's worked quite well.
Agreed. And then so we get a flashback. So a flashback inside the In Media Res, which is that's kind of unique, right?
Yeah. It's like Inception already.
Exactly. And we get this text font. This is Metropolis 3 years ago. And it really stuck out to me as, like, that's odd. It's not like The Flash, where The Flash is always jumping around between Earths and time periods and stuff. And they have a established format of what they show you, like, 2 years ago, Earth 2, you know, 15 years ago, stuff like that. Smallville, like, it's odd that they picked this random font for, you know, Metropolis 3 years ago and then 1 week earlier, later on in the episode. It sticks out to me because it doesn't match the other font of, like, all the credits.
Yeah.
I believe in the pilot, when we flash forward to the present day, in the pilot, after 1989 to 2001, it says present day, and it's in the same font as all the other credits. And I was like, okay, that didn't feel weird, but this just felt weird. This felt like some guy, like, who's using iMovie and isn't really sure how to use text on it, just slap some text. So Lex is arriving at Club Zero, and he has a female companion with him. I love how he comes up to the door, and the guy's like, can I see some ID? And he's like, you must be new here. He's like, how do you not know this is Lex Luthor, right?
I think this is something, because we don't see much of pre-Smallville Lex, from what I remember. So this is, we've heard Lex being a bit of a wild child, or a bit of a spoiled brat, or allegedly anyway, at this point. I think it's like the first time we've seen him in that time period.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and I like the little slice of life you get. This is like Lex pre the accident with Clark, and you know it's been the stance of the show where like you said, he'd been just kind of a reckless youth, and the accident with Clark, you know, saving his life is kind of put him on a new path. That's what we've been led to believe, you know.
Yeah.
So you know, and I have some thoughts on that at the end of the episode when it's revealed what actually happened here, but we'll talk about that when we get there. But Lex is there with his friend Amanda. Now she's engaged, and her fiance is quote out of town. And I had to stop and think, how is Lex even friends with this person?
Yeah, I noticed that because I started trying to work out how old they might have been. Because Lex should be, what, 19?
Yeah, he's either 19 or 20, so...
Yeah, and, yeah, I mean, how many 20-year-olds know people that are engaged who are their age?
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's more of an American thing. I mean, I knew a lot of people engaged when I was in my 20s. It stuck out as odd. Like, he has some, like, really close female friend, like, platonic female friend. Like, yeah. That's odd for Lex Luthor at that stage of his life. And then for somebody who's always been kind of a loner and an outcast, you know. But anyway, it's the setup, right? They need that. They need that setup for... He's obviously friends with this girl. He cares about her. So, long story short, they're at the club, and you know, they order a drink, and then Amanda sees her fiance Jude, and he's, you know, sitting on a couch with two women around him, and he's not out of town on business. So,
but the thing is though, if you're gonna go and like play the field, would you stay in the city that your fiance is in?
Yeah, and it's not like he wasn't with like. Someone he was having an affair with who lived there, right? He was just with random women he met at the bar. Like, why don't you actually go out of town, bro?
Yeah.
So, yes, bad move. He's obviously new at this. So she sees him. She's like, I can't believe you. You told me you're way on business. And he's like, oh, I can explain. It's like, sure, I would have loved to hear him try to explain that. So Jude is played by Corin Nemec. And the most notable thing on his IMDb was he was in Stargate SG-1 for his season. Isn't that right, Matt?
It was, yeah. I think he got quite a lot of grief because Michael Shanks couldn't work out how much money he wanted for season 6, so they kind of wrote him out.
So he was Hawkman's replacement.
Yeah. He was for a season, and he got a lot of grief because he wasn't Daniel Jackson. And then they kind of wrote him out again when Michael Shanks came back.
Oh, so Michael Shanks was there. This character replaced him, and then he left when Michael Shanks came back.
Yeah,
because I never watched Stargate, to be honest. So
because I think it was contract negotiations. I think by the end of season 5, they left their old network, moved to a new network, and I think part of the negotiations fell, and Michael Shanks left. And Corin Nemec was brought in as this new character at the end of season 5 and pretty much took over the Daniel Jackson role for about a season, then kind of went back home.
Interesting. As a Trekkie, that reminds me of Star Trek The Next Generation season 2 when you had Dr. Crusher for season 1, and then you had Dr. Pulaski for season 2, and then you had Dr. Crusher again in season 3 onward. And it's just like, that's odd.
I remember reading that, but I can't remember that. The other Doctor at all.
I'll tell you what, man, this is a controversial opinion in Trekdom, but I actually prefer Dr. Pulaski to Dr. Crusher. And through a various lots of behind the scenes machinations and whatnot, she left and Dr. Crusher came back. Ace McFadden replaced Diana Muldar. So anyway, if you ever go watch Star Trek Next Generation again, watch it with an open mind about season 2, and I feel like Dr. Pulaski, you know, she's a strong female character, and that's something the Next Generation really lacked. So anyway, be that as it may, back to Smallville. So we get this really weird, like, and there's two instances of this in this sequence, actually. So she gets all mad at Jude, obviously. Amanda takes off her engagement ring, and we get this really weird, like, slow motion shot where she takes off her engagement ring and throws it at him. And then earlier, when Lex had been bribing the bouncer to get in, there's a really just slow motion shot of him handing off the $100 bill. And I was like, why do we need slow motion here? Like, could you not have just instructed the actors to just, hey, could you do this a little slower so we can see what's going on?
I think there's a reason for that, because it's the guy he gives the money to, he's wearing a ring with the letter K on it.
Ah.
It's this really, really crap looking, tacky ring in the shape of a K.
Yeah, that is costume jewelry right there.
Yeah, and the only reason, and there's a reason why they keep showing it later on in the episode, because it's quite tacky how it's used later on. But yeah, that's the only reason that slow motion is there, is to try and make the audience see that ring.
I had not thought of that. Good call. Amanda storms out because she's all upset, and Jude kind of figures out that, you know, and I like that it's revealed that Lex pretty much set this up, you know, where he knew that somehow, because he's Lex Luthor, right? He's got connections. He knew that Jude was, you know, messing around on Amanda, went to went to Club Zero, was hanging out, and then brought her there to for a confrontation. Now, have you ever seen, and I don't know if this made it across the pond, the TV show Cheaters?
No, I've never heard of it.
So what it is basically what Lex is doing here, right? So the TV show Cheaters is just this really like garbage TV show in the United States. And what it is if you think your romantic partner is having an affair or cheating on you, you go to Cheaters, the TV show. They do some investigation, and then they will bring you to your cheating significant other, like usually in a public place for a public confrontation. You know, to kind of air it all out. So that's what I felt like here. I felt like, man, Lex is moonlighting as a producer of Cheaters here, because he's just blowing all this up in public. But, you know, that's so much better than if they had just happened to see him there. You know, like what a contrivance that would have been. Like, oh, what are you doing here? You know, for Lex to have known that's what was going on, that adds another. And that's Lex, right? That's what he does. Like, he's a manipulator.
I've not noticed this until now. It kind of links back to something that he talks about at the very, very end of the episode.
That's true.
About, and I think his like main priority was to kind of show his friend that he's, that her fiance is pretty much, well, a sleaze.
Yeah. You know, this episode of Cheaters goes horribly wrong, though, because you know, Lex is following Amanda and Jude, they're all kind of running out together, and they all kind of stop each other, and Jude catches up with Lex and punches him in the face, and like a fight ensues, and then the bouncer intervenes, the guy with the ring intervenes, and he has a gun on him, so like Lex gets stabbed in the shoulder, and then what we see here is that you know, the gun gets loose, and then Jude is gonna, you know, kill Lex probably, and the bouncer kills Jude, and that's what goes down. That's the flashback we see here, and then, you know, we cut back to you know, the interrogation of Lex being hung upside down.
Actually, before I'd just like to point out that the camera goes up through the club, everyone's going, oh my god, someone's been shot, and then cuts to the upper level, and everyone's dancing. Yeah. Like, they now I'm wondering, why is the question is whether a gun can be drowned out by loud music in a club, because like all the upper level of that club, I have no idea what's going on, so they mustn't have heard the gunshot. Or,
yeah, you know, I've never fired a weapon in a club like that, so I can't speak to experience. But you'd think, you know, it's in a closed place, the acoustics are pretty, you know, loud in there. You think you'd have like a Star Wars moment in the cantina where Han Solo shoots Greedo, and then everything stops, the music stops, the people stop. But yeah, you're right. That was pretty funny. Where like, there's obviously people on the ground are shocked, but you pan up and people are just dancing away, not a care in the world. So.
Yeah, it's like someone forgot to tell the extras to like act shocked.
Yeah, like, it's like, oh crap! Oh, well, we don't have time to reshoot it. Just leave it in. Leave it in. So that's our transition back to our flash forward. The flashback goes to the flash forward. The guy who's accusing Lex here, who's captured him, he's like, that's not what happened. Tell me what really happened. And Lex is like, who are you? And then it's revealed that it's Jude. He's like, don't you remember? You killed me. And then he pulls out his gun. He's like, daddy's money can't save it this time, Lex. And we hear a gunshot, and we cut to opening credits simultaneously. So what we're led to believe is Lex has been shot here because Jude had been pointing a gun at him. So, I mean, that's a pretty effective cold open, like we were saying. That's a hook right there. Like, okay, we just saw this guy get shot, and here he is alive with Lex. And he, being Smallville, being a genre show, you assume there's gonna be some kind of sci-fi meteor rock, you know, thing at work here.
Yeah,
it's not, spoiler.
Yeah, I think it's one of like two or three episodes in the season which doesn't have one, and I think it's one of the reasons it probably stands out a bit more. Well, for me personally, but
yeah, it's more like adult, much like Rogue a few episodes ago.
Written by Mark Verheiden as well.
Yeah, and he's one of the best writers on the early seasons, absolutely, I feel. He's just got a strong, I guess, and I use this term when I was talking about Rogue, a more adult show. You know, there's not a lot of high school drama to go in here. We're more in Lex's world and the Metropolis world. It just feels a lot more mature, which definitely makes you stick out from some of the other lesser episodes of the season. So we come back and we got our 1 week earlier caption that we talked about before we come back from the opening credits of this. And we found out that Clark and Pete and Chloe are walking through Smallville High. And, you know, they're going up the stairs. And I thought to myself, man, there are a lot of stairs in this high school. Like, they're still walking up these stairs. So I actually rewound it to see, like, because there's an exterior establishing shot of the Smallville High School before. And it's a three-story high school. And I guess it's something I never really thought about because, you know, who has a three-story high school?
You know? I know secondary school is called over here, where I went to. The one building had, like, three floors, but you can only get to, like, two rooms on the top floor. Hmm. So it's not, like, massively big, but I think there's, like, a second floor on the one building.
Growing up watching Smallville, I was the same age as Clark Kent, and I've said this before on the podcast, and that was a huge reason why, like, this show really connected with me. I was like, oh, man, I'm growing up with Clark Kent. Yeah, this is my life, man. So I guess I just always assume, okay, my high school is two stories, so surely Smallville High School is only two stories. I mean, how many people live in Smallville? How big of a high school do you need? You know what I mean? But through this conversation and them walking, we find out that everyone's just been assigned a biography paper for a fellow classmate. Chloe got Clark, the worst possible person to get Clark, right?
And it's a coincidence that I say in air quotes.
Yeah, so that I actually believe. Now, it's also revealed that Clark got Lana, okay? So
Of course he got Lana.
I feel like he must have used his x-ray vision. You know, I mean, I assume it's like a bunch of names on paper, like in a bucket or something, right? And they all pull them out, and that's my assumption. Because there's no way I refuse to believe the contrivance that Chloe got Clark and Clark got Lana. That's just way too hard to believe. So Clark is kind of evasive here, you know, because he's like, oh man, Chloe's really gonna. I mean, I have secrets, you know. Chloe's gonna. This is not gonna end well for me. So he's like, okay, well, I'm gonna go help Lana with her paper, and she's like, oh, when can I set you up for an interview? And he's like, oh, I'll be around. So he leaves, and Lana is prepping the Talon to open. So you know, this episode obviously takes place a few weeks after the previous episode, because in Kinetic, Lex and Lana had come to this agreement where, okay, hey, we're gonna save the Talon, we're gonna make it a coffee shop, a gentrification of downtown, right? So it's gonna open this weekend. So obviously some time has passed, which is good, because if you recall, Chloe broke her arm in the last episode, you know, and that's not mentioned here at all. So, but hey, they've obviously set it far enough in the future where that's not a factor. So good call on the continuity. Isn't this something that Nell should be doing, though? Like, that was my thought. Like, Lana was supposed to, like, help out, right? Like, oh, I can work, you know, when I'm not in school and be part-time, whatever. And because Nell owned the flower shop and then apparently the theater, from what I understood. And yet she's putting her niece to work, right?
Yeah, she must be subscribed to the Jonathan Kent model of getting children to work.
Cows aren't going to feed themselves, Clark. Yeah, which he literally says that in this episode. That's like, it's the most generic farmer thing to say in the world, and he literally says that. Like, come on, but what did you do before Clark was here with his superpowers, right? We joked about that when in our last episode, Leech, with Mike Krause. We're like, man, like Jonathan, like you've been taking it easy, man, putting Clark to work.
Yeah, I think I remember that. I just wondered whether that's a Smallville thing where, like, every kid's got, like, been worked to the bone from there.
Yeah.
But I keep having to remind myself that Lana's what, 15? She's 15 years old.
I tell myself they're 15. That's how I mean, because when I was in, I had a later birthday, so I was 14 and 15 in Smallville. Listen to me, right? In my freshman year. But, you know, these kids are driving around, you know, they're doing all kinds of stuff. So I'm just going to say they all had early birthdays, right? Yeah. And they're 15, and that's the way I choose to look at it.
Yeah, because I worked it out, because they're a year younger than me, the characters are. And it's, I always just find it either fascinating or slash depressing that they're doing all this stuff and they was like a year younger than me when I was watching it.
Yeah, well, what have you done with your life, right? And
I know, yeah.
As you find out, Lana's getting all the stuff ready, and there's a contractor there who becomes a a much larger role in the plot as it's revealed moving forward. But he's there and he's working on like the plumbing and little things like that are going on.
There's a line that the contractor says and goes, where even on about the pipes, and Lana complains. He goes, you resurrect the past, you get the problems that come along with it.
Yeah.
Which, when you think about the episode in general, it's like, oh, I can see what you're doing.
Yeah,
it's I like, see what you did there.
This guy was all about the dramatic irony. He's like, oh man, I'm going to drop all these sweet lines that no one who's going to understand him. Like, he's talking to Lana. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Someone who's not, he's not talking to Lex. He's not talking to anybody who matters in this story. He's talking to some random girl, as far as he's concerned. And you know, we'll I guess we'll save his motivations and how this all happened for the climax of the episode, but
yeah.
So the contractor, he's doing his thing. Jude comes in to apply for the assistant manager's position, which is just a weird thing. I guess his angle here was just to play mind games with Lex, right?
So, like, I mean, can you imagine that? He goes, hi, can I apply to be an assistant manager to a 15-year-old girl? The economy is that bad.
Yeah. So he comes in, he fills out his application and leaves his name and stuff. Meanwhile, Lex has shown up because he, you know, has a meeting with Lana or something. So Lex pulls up outside, and he gets stopped by the bouncer who we saw at Club Zero. This freaks Lex out. He's like, we were never supposed to, I thought it was understood we were not supposed to have any contact anymore and things like that. He's like, look, I saw him, Lex. I saw Jude. He's everywhere or whatever.
Yeah.
So Lex is like, all right, look, fortunately, Lex has this key to a safe house in Metropolis, you know, just in his pocket, you know, at the time. So he's like, here, I have a safe house in Metropolis. Go there. Wait for my call. Don't go anywhere. Don't see anyone. I'll get back to you.
Yeah, two things. One, he's still wearing that really crap K ring. Because he points at... Because I think he pushes Lex's shoulder with his
right,
finger.
Well, Lex gets out of the car, and the first thing we see of the bouncer is like his hand on his shoulder. So, yeah, attention is once again given to the ring. Absolutely.
And two, I like to think that Lex was actually kind of threatened by the fact there was another bald guy turn up in Smallville. And like he's like, no, you got to go to Metropolis. There's only one token bald guy in this town, and that's me.
Yeah, man, I got this beat covered, man.
Yeah.
So he gets out of there, and so Clark is actually walking out while this is going on, which also encourages Lex to like get this guy out of there as soon as possible. Bouncer guy leaves, and Clark's like, hey, who was that? And Lex's like, nobody. Like he puts on his facade of like, you know, I'm happy, Lex, here in Smallville. So they go in, and I guess I'm not sure how all this timing worked, because while this very brief scene was going on, apparently Jude had finished his application and left.
At what exit?
Right? Isn't there only one? I mean, I guess there's a back door, but why would you... Lana, don't let strangers use the back door. Come on. Hey, she's 15. She doesn't know. So Lex and Clark come in, and Lana's like, hey. Oh, well, Jude also left like a weird warning for Lana. He's like, hey, so Lex Luthor is a owner in this. I don't watch out for him. Everything he touches... falls apart or something like that.
Yeah. Can I, anyway, about the application to work for a business that he owns, can I?
Yeah, exactly. I hate this guy. Yeah. So let me know if I get the job. So they come in and Lana's kind of freaked out and they're like, hey, Lana, what's up? She's like, well, this guy came in and he said he knew you. He told me to stay away from you. And Lex's like, okay, what was his name? And he sees the name on the paper, and it's like a great moment where you see like the wheels are turning in Lex's head, and he's like, okay, like, this is getting weird. So he rushes outside and looks around, and he can't find Jude anywhere. Jude has a tendency to just disappear. Like, does this guy have super speed, right? I mean, throughout the episode, like, he's somewhere, and then, like, you turn your back, and he's gone. And it's like, okay, I guess he just runs really fast. Like, I just imagine him, like, scrambling away as fast as he can whenever people aren't looking. But, you know, Lex is really freaked out by this. He goes off to investigate it by himself, and he gets in his car, and he turns on his car, and then, like, the Club Zero music from the night that Jude got murdered just starts blasting through the car, and it's really, really loud, and Lex can't turn it off, and he's looking around, he can't figure it out, and Clark uses his X-ray vision on the car and sees there's a CD player under the dashboard, which is so, like, late 90s, early 2000s, right? This purple, like, CD Walkman, you know, Lex pulls it out, and it's, like, you know, the Club Zero music on loop.
Yeah, so how did Jude have the time to get out through the back door, go all the way around the block? So I'm assuming the Talon is actually in a massive block. There's no gaps in between the buildings. Get around, break into the car with no signs of entry, hotwire the CD player underneath the dashboard, lock the car, and then leave again.
Those are all good questions, Matt. Those are all very good questions.
Now, your theory about super speed would make more sense.
See, you know, people criticize the Freak of the Week, right? They're like, oh, this is so boring. Somebody's got a power. That's so stupid. Okay, when you have people without powers, none of the, you can't do any of this stuff. There's so many plot holes. Like, if this guy was a freak of the week, you'd say, oh, well, it's part of his meteor power, no problem, right? But since he's not, it doesn't make any sense. But yeah, absolutely, that doesn't make any sense. So Clark goes home after this, and Chloe's already there giving the Kents like the third degree, you know, about Clark's backstory. She's recording, like, she's got cassette tape she's recording on, and asking about, like, so tell me about Clark's youth, and let's talk about his adoption, and what was the process involved, and blah, 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 blah. And you can tell the Kents are very like, whoa, what is going on here? Like, where did this come from? But speaking of outdated technology, Chloe is recording the Kents, her interview with the Kents here on cassette tapes, which is even more outdated than the CD Walkman, right? And fortunately for Clark, she runs out of tape. And it's like, oh, that's okay, I have some extras in my car. She runs off. Yeah.
She actually specifically says C90s.
Yeah.
And I would have thought she would have kept them with her.
Right.
As a reporter. I mean, like, if you're a reporter and you suddenly run out of tape, you'd have backups with you.
Hey, well, she's 15, all right? Yeah, give her a break. She's 15. Yeah. not in good form there, Chloe. But this gives Clark and his parents just a moment here to talk about what is going on here, because they're like, Clark, what is this all about? Why didn't you tell us she was going to do this? He's like, we just got to sign this today. I didn't know she was going to come over here right now. So Chloe's being – you know, I love Chloe. Like, I love Chloe for real as a character. But she was – really annoying and really crossing a line in this episode, I found her.
Yeah, it definitely was. But I think what's interesting, though, is that this kind of opens up, I think, one of the more unique threads that Smallville was in a position to explore in, and it's the mystery of Clark's adoption. I say you're probably the more knowledgeable Superman guy. I'm pretty sure that there's not been no other story that's specific on the adoption of Clark, because I think Smallville's in that unique position to be able to have that as an ongoing mystery. And I think that it's one of the key things that when you see something like that, it's like, oh yeah, that's one of the reasons the show exists, because it's an interesting question, actually. And you wouldn't have seen that in, like, Lois and Clark, or perhaps any other real... Oh, what's the word?
Any other real... any other iteration of the character, right? Well, yeah. I think Small was in a unique position, similar to the fact that the spaceship came down with a meteor shower to kind of hide the fact there was a spaceship there. This is a new day and age. Like, it's the late 80s when this happened. So, technology is at a certain point. This is not just some random backwater town that no one is monitoring, no one knows anything about anymore. Like, you know, in the 30s, obviously, and then even in the Christopher Reeve movies, you know, Clark showed up on, if you do the math there, right, Clark showed up on Earth in 1948 because he was 30 in Superman the movie, 1978. And then, you know, even Lois and Clark, he showed up in the 60s. And so... like, you can get away with all this. Oh, this is my cousin's baby who his parents died, and we took him in, and no one's gonna ask any questions. And there's not a lot of there's not a lot of need for a paper trail and all this kind of. There's not all this documentation stuff like that. But you're right, Smallville's 1989. You got a 3-year-old kid. Like, hey, where did this kid come from? Like, you know, show me some papers. You know, we got to get this kid in public school. We got to know that he's, you know, on the level and all that stuff. So yeah, so that opened up a interesting story angle and a little story arc, I would say, about the whole Clark's adoptions thing. And it actually ties into a lot of other elements in Smallville, and all the pieces of this could put together in season 2. And I like how they just don't put all the cards on the table here. They leave that hanging for us to discover later on in the show.
Yeah, it's definitely, I think it's one of the more, particularly in the early season, one of the better ongoing stories that they did, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, similar to like the Club Zero thing, right? It's like, it's this little thing that, like, what hints were dropped at it, and there's ultimately a payoff, and it's unique to Smallville. Like, it's not like Smallville, like, running out of ideas and like, hey, let's do Fast and the Furious as an episode or something like that, right? And that's what we get later on. They start to just to take, let's do The Hangover as an episode. Like, these were unique things that were faithful to, like, the Superman mythos, but interesting new angles on them instead of just copying and pasting some other popular pop culture thing for story.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So Chloe comes back, and Clark's like, oh, well, I have to go talk to Lana about my project, but I'll see you later. And I love how she asked the Kent. She's like, okay, so here's a question off the record. Don't take this the wrong way, but has your son always been this strange? I thought that was a great line from Chloe.
That's great. I think it's like Martha's reaction. He's kind of like, huh?
Yeah.
We agree.
Clark and Lana, I guess, we see them, and I guess we're to assume that they have had their you know, interview. And I will say this, such a big deal is made out of Chloe getting Clark as a subject here. They don't really do much of the fact that Clark had to interview Lana. I think this is it, right? Like, this is the scene where they're supposed to have been together with their interview, and then that's it. And you think for sure, like, Smallville, who loves Clark and Lana so much, they would spend more attention to that. Now, I understand why they didn't. There was so much going on in this episode as it is, but I feel like in a different episode or wasn't so plot heavy, that we would have gotten more scenes of Clark and Lana, maybe more bonding moments with them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. But I think it's not really a Clark and Lana episode, is it?
No, so I mean, she's really not in it very much.
No, she's not, actually. But I think Manix to keep, I think in terms of editing and story, when they broke the story, they tried to keep as much of the focus on Lex, but still have Clark as an instrumental in the Lex plot. And I think the only reason, and I think having it surrounding the events surrounding the Talon kind of brings Lana into it as well. So you've got your three leads. But I think we see enough of the Clark and Lana.
Oh, I agree. We see enough of Clark and Lana all the time, I feel. Yeah. So more Lex is always a good thing. And, you thinking about it, this is really our first Lex episode that's truly focused on Lex. Like, he has some great moments and some great subplots in all the previous episodes, but he's usually been the B plot. You know, even on episodes like Leech and X-Ray, which are really strong Lex episodes, I feel he's the B plot. You know, and here his story is truly the A plot, and everything revolves around what's going on with him. And to that point, you know, Clark and Lana, they show up at the Talon. They find the contractor is like knocked out, and he says, "Oh, somebody jumped me and forced me to let him in, and I don't know where he went." And Lex shows up because the contractor had called him to meet him there about, you know, going over some plans or something. So Lex is there as well. And they find this box, and it's this present, and it's addressed to Lex Luthor. They open it up, and what's in there?
It's the letter K.
Yes, the bouncer's hand has been cut off, but we know it's the bouncer's hand because it has that K ring on it. So that's why we had been spending so much attention on his K ring. So that's pretty dark, huh? I mean, a body part in a box, like, for Smallville. Kudos to you, show, for going there. So we go to commercial, we come back. And Chloe is grilling Pete about, you know, Clark. And I actually like this little scene. It's brief, but Pete's like, "Hey, look, there's a body part shows up the Talon, like, and you're concerned about Clark, and you get your priorities straight," which is so true.
Has it been, I can't remember, has it been established that Chloe has feelings for Clark yet, or?
It has been implied. Like, there have been, like, some longing looks and some comments and things like that. But there's nothing really. We're getting there, though. Like, we're moving towards that as season one goes. So, but I like that, though, where it's all just, it's very subtle, and they're not beating you over the head with it. Yeah. But that definitely plays into this, because Clark is her, like, you know, Clark is her number one thing.
Yeah. I think she mentions that the only thing I can get is that Clark hates peas.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering why. Is it because of the green? Is that because the color green reminds Clark of, like, Meteor Rock?
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
And I'm just wondering if he just starts to get PTSD whenever he sees anything green. So will do Jonathan? Does Jonathan find him curled up in a ball, crying when he's on grass, or if he, or if he ever meets the Green Lantern, does he just, like, scream and run off?
Through all this meaningless information that she does get, she actually does get one good story from Pete. And Pete tells a story about how in first grade there was this bully at school and was beating up all the kids. And I believe the kid was a couple years older than Pete and Clark at the time. And then it was, like, Pete's turn to get beat up, but Clark, like, got in the way and stood up for him and then pushed the bully, like, through a door and, like, blew the door off the frame. Which is, you know, come on, Clark. Like, I know he's, what is he like? He must have been first grade. You're like six, I think.
I'm pretty sure that's the habit of Clark destroying doors. That must have started then. Because I'm pretty sure. Have you took a tally of how many doors he's broken yet? Or?
Looking back in retrospect, maybe I should have done a tally of how many times he throws people, like, 20 or 30 feet. But that would just be absurd. So, this is where it started. This story right here.
Continuity.
Yeah, continuity, right? And this leads to a nice little moment between Clark and Chloe here. So Pete leaves, like, "All right, well, I got to go do my story," because Pete got assigned some really lame student that he was complaining about to do his paper on, who runs the school store or something. So we're left with Clark and Chloe in the torch office here, and Chloe's just all, she's all happy because she's gotten a scoop. He's like, "Well, since you're not cooperative, I had to do digging on my own, and I found out that you got adopted by Metropolis United Charities, and it was only open for 6 months, which is weird, and you were the only child adopted, and that's weird." And you see Clark, and this is a great, I know it's a small little moment, but I really like Tom Welling in this scene. He really plays it very well. He's like, Chloe, I can't believe you did this. Like, I don't want to know about this. My parents are either dead or they didn't want me, and you did this without my permission, and I'm not some mystery for you to solve. You know, I'm a person. And he kind of storms out. And I felt like, you know, Tom Welling does a really good job in the scene, because it's hard to play that and have it and sell it very well, because it's a different shade of Clark we usually don't get to see. So I like that moment between Clark and Chloe here.
I honestly think as well, it's not Clark trying to protect his secret with capital letters at the start of names, because his secret becomes like it comes like a MacGuffin in itself. But I actually do think that Clark is actually being genuine here in terms that he doesn't really want to know. And I think it's a mix of surprise. We'll find out it's like a surprise that he didn't actually know about the charity itself. But I think he's actually genuinely doesn't want to know or want Chloe to pry in it. Not because it's Chloe's going to find out he's an alien. It's just, I think it's an actual line that he didn't really want someone to cross. And I agree with you. Tom Welling does that quite well. And I do think that it's not what usually happens in what? Chloe, no, I'm not an alien. I don't want to know about my natural parents.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's a good call there, Matt, because that's exactly what it is. Usually, he has a facade of like ignorance or like, you know, I don't know, and no, I'm just a normal guy. But this is truly Clark coming out. How he feels, not protecting, like you said, his secret with a capital S.
Yeah.
So we get Lex, and he's working out in his Luther Mansion gym, which apparently he has, and he's getting his frustrations out in a punching bag. And Jude shows up on the mansion. Once again, he can just show up whenever he wants and leave whenever he wants, kind of a contrivance. But anyway, he demands to know what happened, you know, at Club Zero. So we get another flashback of the events that we saw in the cold open. But this time around, we see that Lex is the one who shot Jude. And this is a great bit of continuity here, because we also see Sam Phelan, who was the dirty cop from Rogue a few episodes ago. And this is great bit of continuity.
Oh, it's great stuff, I think. I think Sam Phelan's one of those characters I kind of wish stuck around a bit more. I mean, or at least showed up again. But then I think Roger Nixon ends up pretty much being the same character, more or less, anyway. But I always just thought it was a great nice knock. Not back.
Yeah, it's an attention to detail that I felt like they kind of let go in later seasons. But here, like, there's a very tight continuity here. We know that, you know, Phelan had helped Lex out in the past. Phelan actually had mentioned this incident at Club Zero before, so we knew he was involved here. This is a classic, like, Lex and Metropolis getting out of trouble with his dad's money. You know, Lex had gotten stabbed, you know, and then here, so Phelan gives him a card to a guy that can take care of him, who we saw in the episode Hug, where he talks about how he patched him up after Club Zero. So lots of great little continuity nuggets here. And you're right, Phelan is such a great character. I almost wish we would have gotten more flashbacks of like pre-Smallville Lex and gotten a little more of him. But I think it's just right. They didn't overdo it or anything. And it's interesting because so after this story is told, we cut back to Jude and Lex, and Jude knows. He's like, hey, apparently the cop who was on that case died, and it sounds like you had something to do with it. I found that very interesting. So this guy has done his homework on this case, you know, and he probably would have gone to Phelan, but Phelan's already dead. Fortunately for Lex, though, Clark shows up right at this moment where he's getting really threatened by Jude with the gun. And Jude just, again, super speed. I don't know, but he runs off, and Clark's like, hey, weren't there two people in here? Like, Lex is like, no, it's just me. I guess this gym has a back door, too.
This must be me just watching The Flash, but I'm pretty sure he's a speedster or something. Yes. Maybe he's Barry Allen. Well, maybe he's one of the Allens.
He's from another Earth, yes.
Yes.
Lex asks Clark to stay out of this because it's just, you know, deep in his world, and you know, we know Clark's not going to let it go, but But Clark had done some investigation, and Lex is nowhere to be found in any of the newspapers or any of the reports, and he can't understand how Lex fits into all this. But our flashback with Phelan had revealed, like, okay, look, you were never here. Your name will not be mentioned in any papers. You know, you're never to see these people again. It kind of sets up why things are the way they are, Lex's conversation with Phelan. So Clark goes back home. He's talking to Jonathan, and we get the cows aren't going to feed themselves line. And we have a really good organic conversation here between Jonathan and Clark. They're talking about Lex for a bit. Jonathan, like, you know, hates on Lex as he usually does, talking about, well, you know, he comes from a dark world, son. You know, these things are going to happen. And then the conversation kind of turns. It's lighthearted because Jonathan kind of mentions the peas, you know, like you had mentioned earlier. He mentions the peas. Oh, sorry. If Chloe mentions anything about you not liking peas, we didn't know what else to say. And then, you know, Clark actually takes the conversation takes a turn. He's like, well, what if she asks about Metropolis United Charities? And it's like, oh. And when we get it from Clark, he's like, ever since I learned the real truth, I hadn't really thought much about the adoption. What's the deal here? And Jonathan kind of stumbles his way through it. And he's like, well, you know, it's complicated, son. And Clark's like, well, is it legal? And Jonathan's, yeah, it's legal. But it took a level of access that your mother and I didn't have. But this conversation is cut short because they go to feed the cows and they find all the cows are dead.
See, that's what happens when the cows feed themselves. Before we go on, because you see the Luther Corp toxic waste. Now, if this was any other episode, that would have mixed in with Meteor Rock and created Freak of the Week.
Yeah.
Now, I like to think there's a hidden episode where the cows become Freaks of the Week and and Clark has to fight the superpowered cows. The
zombie cows, yeah.
Yes, yeah. I've already come up with a hidden episode title of Dairy.
Yeah.
So I like to think that's the hidden episode of this.
That or Lactose might be a good one.
Yes, Lactose.
That's the great thing about these Smallville titles, right? These one words.
Yeah.
They start to get ridiculous after a while. That's a good point. So, as you said, it's revealed the Luther Corp, just barrels of like toxic Luther Corp waste have been spilled all over the Kent land here, and obviously one, this was to tarnish Alexa's image in Smallville. And two, I don't know, maybe Jude had caught on to Clark being around and wanted to do something with the Kents. I'm not really sure why they zeroed in on the Kents. Obviously, it's good for the plot because it brings the Kents in closer with Lex and all that.
And it's a good image. I think it's actually quite a creepy image as well. When the camera kind of pans up and you do see a lot of CGI cows just like dead.
I was going to say, like, it's got to be CGI, right? Like,
yeah.
But it's pretty good. I mean, it looked pretty accurate to me. Yeah, it was very X-Files moment. Really creepy occurrence at a very mundane environment. You know, just like a herd of dead cows. So, and I really like how Jonathan responds to all this. Lex shows up and he's just very like, you can tell Lex is like, how am I going to deal with this? This guy already hates me. now I've killed his entire livestock. And
yep.
He goes up to Jonathan. He's like, well, I'll pay for your livestock, of course. And Jonathan's like, of course, always money with you. Money can't solve all your problems, Lex. It's like, well, actually, that's a pretty good deal. He's going to fix all your problems with the money. So that's the classic Jonathan. That's the classic Kent and Luther, conversation there, right? Just because they have money doesn't mean all your problems go away, which is true, but still.
I mean, technically, it's what the episode's about, because I think money was thrown away and it hasn't solved the issue that Lex is facing at the moment when you think about it.
Yeah, it's like kind of the crux of like the Luther world clashing with the Smallville world that he's in now. Lex is told that the government health and safety guy needs to talk to him. And who is it? But it's Jude, right? This guy has unlimited resources. He has like the whole government get up on and stuff like that. And he confronts Lex, then he tases Lex. This is our second appearance of the Batman Returns issue taser, which we saw in the last episode that Lex had in Kinetic. So he tases Lex, throws him in a van, and kidnaps him. So after this, we get a short little Clark Martha scene where Martha, to your point, Matt, about Martha talks about, look, I grew up in Metropolis. I know in the Luther world, the kids grow up too fast. There's money, and she's telling him, like, hey, look, I'm usually the one defending Lex, but why don't you keep your distance from him until this all blows over? Which is solid advice from Martha, I think.
Yeah. Because I think Martha's the closest we've got to a moral center in the show, I think. She's all the moral compass.
Not Jonathan.
No, Jonathan's... He's got a very biased opinion, and he's very closed off, and he's not open, and he doesn't he doesn't think of all people or all angles at once. He's very much quick to jump at, no, that's bad. No, Clark, you shouldn't do that. You got to be careful.
Martha's more thoughtful about it.
Yeah, Martha, because Martha's probably can see, he's more open to see the potential of good in Lex. So when Lex kind of says, I just want to do right by whatever, Martha can perhaps see that, or can see that there's potential there, whereas Jonathan's more or less just got his opinion straight away, doesn't want to see the grey area of Lex. Martha's probably more capable of being to see that. But when Martha says to Clark, hang on, you need to step back and let Lex go on his own a bit, I think there's more of an impact there than perhaps Jonathan saying it.
Right, because Jonathan said that from the jump. Like, he never really gave Lex a chance. But when Martha's saying it, you know, like, to take it seriously for sure. So while all this is going on, Chloe shows up, and Clark is still kind of standoffish, giving her the cold shoulder. And, you know, because she had been, well, Chloe had shown up and been taking pictures of, you know, all the cows and everything going on. And, they kind of patch stuff up. They have a nice moment here of, you know, reconciliation, I guess, of their friendship. And Chloe says, you know what, I'm just going to drop the whole thing. And I thought, is this not a school assignment? Like, you still have to write something about Clark. Yeah. You know, this is some expose you decided to write. I guess she's going to drop all the adoption. So it's nice to see them patch things up. And it's funny because she sees this article that Clark had printed out about Club Zero. She's like, what's this? And Clark's like, that's something in Lex's past that he asked me to stay out of. And she's like, oh, okay. I thought that was a cute moment there where he's like, he's guilty of doing the very thing he accused Chloe of. And she also hands over these very helpful pictures. We saw her taking pictures of, you know, the cow incident. And she's like, oh, here's some pictures I took in case your parents needed them for insurance or something. And she hands over Clark this stack of pictures. And it is... She takes the closest close-up you could possibly get of Jude, the government guy. Like, I'm like, are you serious?
And I'm pretty sure that quality picture isn't capable with the camera she's got.
No way. No way a digital zoom is going to... Unless she was, like, in his face, like a selfie. There's no way you're getting that close. So yeah. I was kind of a two minds about this. I'm like, okay, this is ridiculous. Like, she doesn't have some 400-millimeter lens on her camera. How did she get this kind of... Obviously, it's just a screen grab from the scene of Lex talking to Jude earlier. Yeah. Is what it is. But actually, would you have preferred, like, some, like, wide shot where he's, like, in the very corner and we have the whole enhance trope? You know, I mean, I'm so sick of seeing that trope all the time. I actually kind of like how it was just, you know what, here's a picture of the guy, let's just move the story along.
yeah we can't be honest, we want to finish the episode now, come on.
I know, right? I mean, Clark could have used his supervision to see it on the paper, but no, like, here it is, here's the guy. So this ties some threads together for Clark, and him and Chloe get on the case here. She ends up, you know, calling around and finds out, you know, who this guy is and where he has some property in Metropolis. And Clark's like, how'd you find all this out? She's like, see, sometimes being persistent is good. So,
I'm going to interrupt again, because they're in the torch now, aren't they?
Yes, yeah, they're in the torch now.
What I've noticed, I think in a future episode, and I think I've tweeted this to the Twitter account, that I noticed in the background there was like a massive life-size monkey wearing the crow's jersey.
Yeah.
Now, I had to rewind, and I've spotted something else in this episode at 45 seconds in. There's a mannequin's arm sticking out of the wall holding a rubber chicken. I kid you not.
And the prop department must be having some fun with this set, huh?
So I'd like to appeal to any listeners out there who are either trying to catch up or watching the episodes. Any scene in the torch, pause it and just see if there's any other strange stuff in the background, because that's two now. And unless you see it, you don't notice it. But now there's this rubber chicken being held by an arm stuck on the wall. I'm gonna have to get a screenshot and I'll tweet at you later.
But... Oh, that'd be great, man. That'd be great.
But I'm really hoping that there's more stuff.
Well, this is the fun about rewatching a show like this. You know, you kind of you can kind of delve into that weird minutia that you're not really paying attention to the first time around.
Yeah.
So Clark finds out. Chloe tells him the address of where Jude had some property in Metropolis, and Clark speeds there. And when he's there, like, oh, there's all these cops there. There's a crowd. They're taking out a dead body. Clark does the X-ray under the body bag, and he sees that it's the bouncer, because he can see that his hand's been cut off, the skeleton. So that's a pretty cool way to use X-ray vision to not show something gruesome. You just see the hand missing from the skeleton. And kudos to Clark here. He's thinking on his feet, because he asked the police officer, like, well, is there anyone else in there? And the police officer says no. And so Clark, you see that he isn't not really sure what to do next. And he's like, oh, do you know where Club Zero is? And the police officer tells him, oh, you're too late, kid. It closed 6 months ago. So Clark's like, all right, but he speeds off. So that's good thinking on Clark's part to at least think about going to Club Zero. And then it's revealed that is where Lex is. So that is where he's being captured. That's where he was in the cold open in the flash forward. Jude has captured him and put him in Club Zero. Basically, it's the same scene again from the cold open. It's a little different, which is kind of a continuity problem. There was a couple lines of dialogue I thought were different. You know, it's like they used a different take of the scene or something just for variety's sake. But you shouldn't do that because this is literally the events as they took place. So I don't know. And you know, it was very powerful in the cold open where we saw Jude for the first time. It's like, hey, it's me. You killed me, remember? But it's not so powerful here. Like, why would that conversation take place at this point, you know, based off the story we've seen already? You know what I mean? It's not like this mysterious guy has been doing stuff to Lex. Lex has already had two conversations with him. So we get the gunshot again from the cold open. But it's he gets basically Jude gets Casino Royale'd here. You know what I mean? He's Lex being James Bond and Jude being Lashif. He gets shot from off screen, and it's the contractor, right? The contractor is Mr. White, and he's killed Lashif. You're like, what is going on? The contractor guy, you know, and the contractor, he turns on all the lights and the Club Zero music starts going and all the lights and all this stuff. And once again, where are all these resources coming from? Like they've repowered and relit and everything in Club Zero, right? So he cuts Lex down and Lex's like, who the hell are you? You know, what is going on here?
So, I mean, the song, I think, is God is a DJ by Faithless. So that guy must have bought quite a few copies of it. He must have at least bought it on CD.
Yeah, this is pre-iTunes, you know? So
yeah, so he must have tried and tracked down the CD single just in case it wasn't the first track off an album. So he had to go and find the CD single. I mean, he must have scoured, I don't know, record stores or something for it. And then must have tried and bought a vinyl version to play in the DJ booth. I mean...
Man, but, you know, very, very intricate plan here. But what's revealed here is that, first of all, this contractor guy is Amanda's brother, okay? And it's revealed that Amanda had committed suicide about a year after the Club Zero incident, and her brother here had been in jail, so it kind of establishes that he's a shady guy, and he blames Lex for her death because, you know, nobody... I guess Amanda never told him that she killed Jude. Spoiler alert, right? We get the final flashback here where he's like, tell me what really happened. Lex's like, all right, I'll tell you what really happened. And we get the flashback again, and it's not Lex that shot Jude, it's Amanda. And this is a classic Lex moment here where he explains, you know, he's like, I just wanted to protect her because he knew that, and we see this again in the show, actually, you know, that Lex knows that Lionel will protect him over anything else because he's his only son. He's his legacy, regardless of their rocky relationship. They have that twisted family bond where, you know, Lionel's always going to get him out of trouble. So he knew Lionel wouldn't help Amanda from murdering Jude, but he knew if Lex knew if he had done it, Lionel would pay whatever it took to get him off that situation. So that's the reveal there. And then this guy doesn't really believe it. He gets mad about it, but then Lex is like, who is that guy talking about Jude? Who is he? Because it's clearly not Jude. And it's revealed that the contractor, he's like, yo, you know how they say everybody has a double. I don't know. I've never heard that. Who says that? Right. But,
no idea.
This is his doppelganger, you know, the whole doppelganger theory. Right. But, he says like he was in some, you know, burger joint or something and saw him cooking burgers and was like, oh, it's a spitting image of Jude, you know, and I thought if he could fool me, he could fool you too. And it's like, really? Like, what a ridiculous, intricate plan. Like, what, at the end of the day, what did you think of this plan?
Before I do that, did you catch where he was?
Yeah. So the brother lived in Central City, which I was like, oh, Flash reference, right? That's awesome.
Yeah.
And then he says, I was in Bloodhaven where he saw the new Jude, the fake Jude, yeah. Right? So that's two DC comic city references, which was like, oh, wow. I didn't catch those the first time years ago when I saw this. So good job on you, Smallville Universe Building, right?
Yep. But in terms of the plan, it's a bit of a... I don't know. I mean, the twist... I think the twist works.
Oh, yeah, the twist works. The plan is a little too convoluted for its own good, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think the twist actually overshadows any attempts to work out the plan because you never... I remember thinking it was a dead man walking it. The first time I watched it. Mm-hmm. But when you actually think about it, it's what terrorize the person you think killed someone who caused your sister to commit to it. Okay, my brain
it really starts to break down, right?
Yeah.
And Lex asks, like, why did Jude 2.0 over here do it? And the contractor tells him, well, he was on parole, he needed the money. It's like, oh, wow, okay. Like, needed the money. Like, I'm going to assume Amanda was very well off. You know, she's friends with Lex Luthor, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe she's from a very well-off family or used to be, and she had a lot of money. Her brother inherited it all when she died, and that's why he has all these absurd resources you know, to reopen Club Zero and to have like a whole fake government agency costume for Jude and all this stuff. You know what I mean? That's my only really justification for any of that. But it's a little too convoluted. But you're right. The twist works, and it's a good turn. But here's my deal, and I mentioned this earlier when we were first talking about it. It's very altruistic of Lex, right, to take the fall for his friend. Like he says, I'd do anything for my friends, right? But I feel like this is incongruent with the Lex Luthor who we were led to believe existed before the car accident with Clark. Like, we were led to believe that was a life-changing event, and, like, he was on a dark path, and Clark put him on a new path, you know, at least for a while. And before that, he was just all out for himself, doing whatever, just a real brat. And Lex even describes himself as like a spoiled rich brat, you know. Not to get ahead of ourselves, but in season 3, the episode Memoria, we see a similar situation. But Lex is a lot younger then, so I don't see a continuity problem with it there. I feel like he's younger and he's not jaded to the world, you know, stuff like that. before his mother had passed away, obviously, so he was a different person then. And that's another major, you know, thing in his life. You know, his mother's passing away, and then obviously the accident with Clark. Those are major touchstones in Lex's life. And I don't know, like, would the Lex Luthor from Metropolis have done something like this, like, to protect his friend? I don't know.
Thing is, though, I'm just wondering how much of it was protecting his friend or him really wanting to sleep with Amanda. Because that makes... So I think if you think about it, it probably makes more sense if he kind of did it because he wanted, I don't know, he saw her as some sort of challenge or conquest or something. I can see Lex perhaps enjoying the chase of trying to get or trying to seduce Amanda or trying to get Amanda and kind of manipulated her, destroying her relationship, and then but then his plan went a bit sour when she ended up killing her fiance.
That's a great observation there. I hadn't thought about that, because when they first walk in the club, the bouncer's like, "Hey, she's cute," and Lex is like, "She's engaged," you know. So that's an interesting point.
Not for long.
Yeah, not for long, right? Yeah. I like that. Now that fits in with Lex, the manipulator of situations and people, right? I can totally see him doing that. So that. Even if the episode wasn't saying that, I'm going to choose to believe that was what his angle there was.
So, yeah, and I part of me kind of thinks that he was only there to try and... I think he was friends with her, but kind of wanted to sleep with her or something. Just kind of selfish reasons rather than altruistic reasons.
Well, because even now, even the new reformed Lex always has his own motivation, right? He's never truly altruistic. Even with all the stuff he does with Clark, he has ulterior motives. Even with, you know, all the stuff with Lana and that talent, he has his ulterior motives, it seems. So that would really be in line, though. I like that. I like that interpretation, Matt. That's real good. Lucky for Lex, though, here's the deal. I'm not sure what happens here, because the brother, the contractor guy, he picks Lex up, and he's like, "I'm sick of your lies, Luther." He doesn't really believe him that Amanda shot Jude. And he's going to shoot him, but then it's weirdly edited. Another weird bit of editing. Like, we see Lex kind of elbow him from the straitjacket. and then that misdirects the bullet to shoot like the glass case that Lex is laying on, and that shatters, and Lex doesn't get shot, and then he falls to the ground. Clark shows up here and super speeds around. He knocks out the brother, and he pushes a couch to catch Lex and all that stuff. But are you sure what happened? Were you clear on what happened here?
I don't actually think about it. It is quite messy. I think it's more or less just try and get the image of Lex falling surrounding glass, and for Clark, just to give something that looks good so Clark can do what he needs to do and then lead it again. But we're thinking about it, I can't remember how he gets pushed out, and I've only watched it a bit.
Yeah, exactly. It just, and I rewound it like twice to try to figure it out when I was watching it. I'm like, no, I still don't see the physics here. Like, if you elbow somebody with a gun, it's going to go up, not down, right? So it's not going to shatter the glass that he's laying. I don't know, but you're right. I think it adds a lot more dynamic imagery when Lex is falling from this height, and there's glass and water as well, I believe, falling all around him. Clark has to push this couch in, and then he super speeds up and knocks out the brother. Like, if Clark had just come on and super sped in and knocked out the brother, that'd be kind of boring. And then also, it'd been right in front of Lex, so you kind of need this contrivance to have Clark be able to save the day without being directly responsible. And I do like how after Clark saves everybody, he runs back outside and then runs back in at normal speed. Like, oh, Lex, what's going on in here?
I'm pretty sure he doesn't do that often.
No, he doesn't, but that's a great touch here because, like, he should be doing that. And, in fact, I thought to myself, he should have not even come back at all. You know what I mean? Like, he's putting himself at the scene of the crime. I mean, he could have maybe, somebody could have called the cops about Club Zero. I don't know. I feel like he inserted himself into the situation where he didn't have to, you know?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So we get to the Talon opening night. This is the end of the episode here. Talon has his grand opening. It's kind of a suit and tie kind of thing for a local coffee shop, you know? But yeah. Hey, whatever, right? And did you catch Whitney made an appearance?
I know, yeah. Wow.
I was thinking Whitney was not in this episode at all. And then here he is, just doesn't get any lines, doesn't get a close-up at all. We just see him in the background kind of talking a lot and just talking to a crowd of people. It's like, okay, Eric Johnson, here's your check for this episode. Way to go. Yeah, I mean, obviously he's the most disposable character, literally, as it turns out, but of the main cast this time around. So Clark and Lana have a nice little exchange here. He gives her a present.
There's a nice little line where he goes, and what do you think? And Clark's first words is, I'm definitely surprised. Which I'm like, well...
The way it came across is, wow, I'm surprised so many people showed up to this. Instead of like, goes, wow, Lana, yeah. I'm surprised that you accomplished all this. Good job.
Yeah. Or goes, wow, Lana, I'm surprised. Are these the people you didn't serve at the beanery?
Yeah. I was like, aren't you that girl that worked at the beanery and really sucked at her job?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
No. That was my doppelganger.
Yeah, everybody has one. You know, yeah. It's what, you know what they say. Anyway, so Clark gives her this vintage picture of the Talon that he found in like the attic, and it was his grandfather's or something like that. She says, "Oh, I'm gonna hang this right over the register, right over the counter. So I'm gonna keep an eye out for this. I sincerely doubt we will ever see this picture again. It would be so easy for the prop department just to put it there, but yeah. I would actually be surprised if we ever see it again. But it's a nice little like gesture from Clark to give her that." Then Lex kind of slides in after Lana walks off, and he's like, how do I get the feeling that you're avoiding me? And Clark says, well, I just realized there's a lot of things that I don't know about you. And Clark actually questions, he's like, is that really what happened? Did it? Because Lex justifies, like, look, I was just protecting Amanda. I knew my father would protect me and not her. And so he's explaining to Clark why things went down the way they did. And Clark is still a little bit hesitant. He's like, is that really what happened? And so what do you think? Do you think that's really what I think Lex was being truthful. I think that Amanda shot you, and I think that was it. But it's interesting that Clark still had that kernel of doubt.
Yeah, I quite like the idea that Lex was being truthful. But then again, I think when you look back at some of the, you know, the scene where Phelan pays off whatever his name
was. The bouncer, yeah.
Yeah, he goes, you saw what happened. Right, in front of about 100 odd people who also saw what happened. So I've got this image of now that Phelan pretty much bribed every single person.
Mm-hmm. Well, then that's probably why the Club Zero thing was the big deal in Lex's past. Like, there's a dead body, and like hundreds of people had to be paid off. You know, the writer of this episode, Mark Verheiden, has this to say about the end of the episode. He says, I like the idea that at the end of the episode, I don't think you really know if Lex killed Jude or not. You're left wondering. His story is that he didn't. But by then, we've seen three or four unreliable narrators tell different versions of this event. Now, I completely disagree. all due respect to the writer of the episode, Mark Verheiden. We were just singing his praises earlier. But I don't get that impression at all. I get the impression that that was the truth. You know, like you said, it's good. It's a good character moment for Lex to be telling the truth here. We see some of his altruistic, or you know, we already kind of debated what his motives truly were at the time.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting layer to Lex's character. A lot more interesting than, oh, hey, maybe he was lying too. And no, and then also three or four unreliable narrators. No, Lex has been the only narrator through all the flashbacks. Yeah. You're not talking to different points of view. Like, and you know, he also makes a point. Have you ever seen the movie Rashomon?
I haven't. I've got it on DVD, but I've never watched it. But I know the storytelling technique, because I think there's been a few other TV shows that have used it as well. But yeah, I don't. Have you ever watched Farscape?
No, I've not watched Farscape.
there's a great, great episode which uses that trope, that story premise of the Rashomon thing, mm-hmm. where you see different characters from different viewpoints.
Well, that's what Verheiden says here. He also says, we really wanted to try to do that sort of Rashomon idea, where you see the same event through different perspectives. But that's not what happens here. Like, it's all from Lex's perspective. So I feel like they're off the mark with that analysis of what they did here. Because I never got the impression, oh man, maybe Lex was lying the whole time. I never got that impression, but anyway.
No, not at all. What I got the impression of was that Clark wasn't fully convinced that the truth was there, which is quite interesting considering that it's usually the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's usually Lex is the one suspicious of Clark. Telling the truth. And so we get one final tag of this episode here, and it's Chloe in the Torch office, and she has her Metropolis United Charities file open on Clark, and the whole mouse goes back and forth and back and forth, and she can't decide if she's going to save or delete it. And she eventually decides to save it. Now, I don't see this so much as being a moment for Chloe, but more a moment for the show, telling you, like, hey, we're not going to forget about this. We're going to come back to this. You know, because from Chloe's perspective, you know, if you look at it from Chloe's perspective, like, why is this even a big deal? Like, they're like, oh, is she going to save it or is she going to delete it? You know, this is a trope they repeat in the season two premiere of Vortex, where she's literally the same exact scene, except for it's not the Metropolis United Charities document. It's pictures of her and Clark at the spring formal. You know, and she's like, should I save it or delete it? And I feel like that is a lot more like speaks to the character of Chloe more than this does. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I do quite like, I like the idea of perhaps that, because we always got the impression that Chloe thinks well on her feet and is quite investigative, that she was about to delete him, but then perhaps something in the back of her mind was saying, hang on, before you do that, don't you think it was funny how the Kents reacted to so-and-so, and it's that reporter part of her head kicking in. So I quite like that ending. I mean, if you think about it as Chloe kind of second-guessing her own initiative. She kind of stumbles onto something, and we can see that she's quite persistent in trying to find the truth. And it's almost a character flaw that she has to know the truth about stuff, that she can't... She knows something's not right, so she can't let go of it. And we see that quite consistently throughout the show.
Well, ultimately, and that's just why it's disappointing that ultimately Chloe figuring out Clark's secret, she's literally just shown his secret by another character. It would have been cool for her to figure this stuff out on her own, to that same point that you're talking about her persistence and her journalistic intrigue and stuff like that. But it is a good ending, and I just feel like it's a little lessened by the fact that they do this exact same thing in Vortex with the pictures. It's like, come on, guys, mix it up some.
I get the feeling you're avoiding me, Clark. I realize there's a lot I don't know about you. You think my dark past is gonna rub off on you? I was trying to protect Amanda. My father wouldn't have raised a finger to help her, but I knew he'd do anything to save his only son.
So you took the fall and everything was covered up. Is that really what happened? Is it the truth?
The truth is, I'd do anything to protect my friends.
Zero got an 8.0. on IMDb, and Neil Bailey from the Superman homepage in his small review gave this episode a 4 out of 5. So, you know, a pretty strong rating for this episode. And, you know, I would agree with him. I think this is a great episode. And Matt, what would your rating be? And on here on Always Hold On to Smallville, what we do is we rate everything from a letter grade system. So if you had to give this a letter grade, what would you give it?
I've been thinking about this, and the letter grade is quite difficult for me because I got into university with a C and two Ds when I finished high school. And to me, C and two Ds is really good. but I'm assuming it's going to be similar to the AV Club, how they grade stuff with letters. I'm going to say a B+.
Okay.
Purely because it's a good episode, and I think it's one of the better ones from season one. But in terms of the whole show, I think it will do a disservice to try and give it an A, because there are episodes later on which are so high quality A grade material that just blows this episode out of the water. So I'm going to go with a B+.
All right. Awesome. Now, I was similarly in that same range. I ended up deciding on like A- for this episode, because I feel like, you know, it's a very strong, like we mentioned earlier, adult episode, a Lex-centered episode, which is great. A lot of payoff to some plots that had been hinted at earlier in the season, and a lot of seeds planted for future plots. So there's a lot going on here for the greater Smallville mythology and what would otherwise been just a filler episode, you know, just a Lex adventure. And I, you know, delving into Lex and his past and his motivations is always very interesting, and just a very strong episode. You know, the whole thing with Chloe and Clark, you know, and we start to see her, you know, pushing too much, and that's a theme that will go on through more seasons here, pushing too much to find out about Clark. But you know, the weaknesses for me would be more like the logistics of the villain's plan. you know, mm-hmm. The resources required to pull it off and things of that nature. So, but yeah, I'm going to go with A-. Like, and I might be being a little, I mean, look, Smallville's my favorite show. So I'm probably grading these a little more favorably. Although I sound like when I listen back to myself, like, man, I'm very critical. And I'm like, man, none of this crap makes sense. A+, great episode. but hey, you know, I do try to be fair. Last week, Kinetic, that was, in my opinion, the worst episode of season one we've gotten so far. Even worse mm-hmm. than the fat sucking vampire episode. So those
with the Oscar winner in it.
Yeah, with the Oscar Academy Award winner Amy Adams. So those are down there, you know. So I'm gonna call a spade when it's bad, it's bad. But you know, for these good episodes, it's hard because you're right. There's a lot of excellent episodes coming up.
I think there's a difference between something being that bad that it's bad, and Smallville does go that route in the lighter seasons. But then you got that critical angle, but then you still got stuff that you can still enjoy, and you might be aware of how if it's not the best thing ever, but you can still sit down and you can still watch it, and you'll see the there's like the sparks of something great in there, even though you can point out the flaws. The entertainment value is a lot better, and that outweighs the stuff that annoy people.
So we have some business to attend to, don't we, Matt? We have the Smallville Tally Board. So do you like the Smallville Tally Board? Do you think it's fun?
Yeah, I think it's quite entertaining, actually, when you start to see. And I think quite entertaining to see. And I'm watching what I'm watching at the moment. I can't wait to see that number go up very, very quickly.
Yeah, it's going to really, I mean, mind control alone and amnesia is just going to skyrocket. But yeah, so the only we have a couple things to talk about on the tally board here. I'm adding this new category for this week, in media res. All right, this is going to be number one because this is a trope that shows up a lot more than it should later on in Smallville. So this is number one for in media res. And then also we have the Bechdel test, which we talked about, which is if two female characters have a conversation not revolved around a male. And this episode fails.
It does.
As most episodes of Smallville do. And I don't think it's unfair that I have this as a category because almost half the main cast are women. So, you know, at some point you think they might have a conversation about, you know, something that's not a man or have yeah. a conversation at all. Like, it's like not only did this episode fail the Bechdel test, there is never a conversation between two women that takes place in this episode.
You could argue, but no, Jonathan's involved, isn't it? When she's talking to Martha and Jonathan. Yeah. But
I found that your best bet is to have Nell and Lana have a conversation. That's been the best bet so far. So, but anyway, so we failed that. But you actually had you were talking about off microphone. You were talking about a website you had been to, at tvtropes.com.
Yeah, it's a brilliant site that you could end up being like getting lost in for days. It'll talk about it'll name certain tropes, and it goes through certain TV shows. Well. Certain tropes, certain episodes of TV. I've now got the one open for Zero. And how many tropes do you think TV Tropes has acknowledged on this page?
In this episode? Oh, yeah. Wow. 7?
It's got 13.
13! Oh, wow. Okay, please yeah. enlighten us.
Well, some of them are quite niche or quite specific, but there's one like alliterative name, which is Roy Rothman, the Big Brother instinct trope, which is Roy taking this extreme after Amanda's suicide, dead person impersonation.
Okay.
The name I love, which is called The Dog Was the Mastermind.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense.
Which refers to the talent contractor, so like someone you only see briefly. Turns out it was him all along, that kind of stuff. Driven to Suicide is another one. How We Got Here, which is, I think, basically the in media res.
Okay, yeah.
One. The Man Behind the Man, which is basically Jude being the puppet of Roy. Mundanger, which refers to the fact that Roy Rothman has no superpowers. So Mundanger, I think he's just referring to people, the villains that have no powers, etc.
Okay, gotcha, yeah. I like that mundane danger word. That's good.
Yeah, Mundanger. So I wonder how many mundane villains there have been on Smallville so far?
Gosh, like two?
Well, you got Roy and you perhaps Phelan.
Phelan and maybe Roger Nixon.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not really an antagonist quite yet, but yeah.
No, there's the mythology gag, which is basically the central city in Bloodhaven. Posthumous character turning up is Sam Phelan.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, the revenge trope, which is self-explanatory. Villain of the week is an actual trope.
Okay.
And it just, which I think applies to every episode of Smallville. an interesting one is called What the Hell Hero, which is when your hero is a bit of an arse. And it gives a transcript of the Chloe Clark scene when she's on about, you know, the one that we praised earlier, saying where Tom Welling does well, that he says, you shouldn't be looking into my life. It actually points that scene out as an example of that trope of the hero doing stuff that you don't expect heroes to do, which is an interesting point to make.
But I guess that just shows you everybody's different taste and analysis because, you know, we really like that scene, as you said, and they're like, oh, this is stupid. So
We've got two more. We got the woman scorn trope, which is Amanda, and your cheating heart, which is Amanda Rothman, caught her fiancé Jude cheating on her, leading to the incident that killed him.
Wow.
So,
well, that's quite a list.
It's an interesting sight, and you can kind of get lost reading about these different tropes, and you can then go by trope or you go by series, and it goes quite in depth. But Smallville's full of them.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, that was part of my idea doing the tally board, but man, that's even beyond. And that's just what the tally board would I do is like, that's just for Smallville itself. I mean, that's talking about like TV or fiction in general, you know. So that's interesting. Yeah, sight there.
Yeah.
How about we make that your thing, Matthew? Whenever you're back on the show, you will read us the TVTropes.com report about the episode. That'll be your thing.
Yeah, I look forward to it.
So, Matt, if people want to find you on the internet, where can they do that?
Well, you can visit my website, which is www.bottleepisode.co.uk. We're on Facebook and Twitter under The Bottle Ep. And I've also got a personal account, which is private at the moment, but if I like you, then you can add me, which is X and Matt on Twitter.
I gotta say, Matt, you're the first guy with his own website to be my guest. So I'm very most legit guest I've had yet. So
whether people read my website is a bit of a is a question, but I am currently watching through Smallville, and I'm trying to aim to go through them, and I think once a month you'll probably have you'll see an additional season show up. So I'm currently like capsule reviewing the seasons. So I've done season 1 and 2 so far. So there'll be like about, 8 or 9 lines an episode. And I'm hoping to go through the rest of them. I've finished season 3. That's scheduled to go up at the end of this month, I think. And I'll hopefully carry on with the rest of them. So I'm currently starting season 4 now.
Nice. Well, good luck getting through that one. That's Not to spoil your enthusiasm, but season 4, probably the worst, if not the second worst season of the show, in my opinion. Based off my preferences. Now, a lot of people like season 4, but based on what I like about Smallville, season 4 did not give me what I wanted.
Season 4 is like the first season. Well, season 4 onwards, I've not rewatched at all. I've only seen the episodes once. 1 to 3, I've seen 3, maybe 4 times beforehand, so I've rewatched those first 3. Season 4, I've not watched since it aired like 10 years ago.
Well, I'm really looking forward to your opinions on those. Yeah. I really like your capsule reviews, as you call them. It's fun to see somebody else's perspective. You have some sarcasm in there too, which is always very helpful. Like some self-aware sarcasm about the show, which I love. which is what we do all the time on this podcast. Yeah. Clearly.
Well, I think quite a few of the my view of the episode has been kind of skewish since I've started listening to these, so and I'm starting to pick up things that I probably wouldn't have been looking for. I mean, the what day is it on Smallville? I mean, I've started noticing that now. I'm like, oh, hang on, oh, damn you, Zach.
Well, that's awesome. That's good to know. We're influencing your viewing. Now, you will be far, far, far ahead of us by the time you finish the show. So we will not be coloring your opinion in specific episodes. And I'm glad we can at least introduce those thought processes to you. So for us, the podcast itself, you can find us on Twitter at Always Malville. That's Always Malville with one S. Find us on Facebook at Always Hold On to Smallville. And if you want to send us an email at alwaysmalville with one S at gmail.com. And as for me personally, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoronZach. All right, well, that's going to do it for this week on Always Hold On to Smallville. We'll be back next week. Lance Lasseter will be back, and we'll be talking about Nicodemus. Until then, always hold on to Smallville.